is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. This is a no-nonsense podcast. We're not going to waffle. We're not going to get into any nitty-gritty details about our lives. You don't care. Here's what you want. You want some reviews. We're going to deliver you some reviews. Simon's going to talk about Asteroid City, the new Wes Anderson movie. He's going to talk about another new film. It's called Dracula, Voyage of the Demeter. What on earth is a Demeter? It doesn't matter. We'll find out. Gran Turismo. I am reliably informed this is a movie and not some sort of behind-the-scenes DVD extra like the trailers may purport it to be. Boy, that trailer, Simon. That trailer. Strange Planet. It's a TV program on Apple TV+. I'm going to give you the skinny on it. And then I'm going to pivot into the world of a three-part HBO original documentary series. It's called Telemarketers. Folks, that is already too much show. But we're going to give you more. We're going to do a deep dive into the news of the week. There's six stories that are rattling around in our brains, collective brain. We're going to go through that. We're going to tell you what else we've been watching. We've got some history the week. We've got some birthdays to get through. We've got silly dad jokes. We've got so much going on. Will there be nudity? Yes, there'll be nudity. Folks, this is Screen Watching. Let's dive deep into the reviews.
It stinks.
Simon, ooh, you want to tell us about Asteroid City, which I believe is a new movie playing in cinemas.
It is a new movie. Great opening. That was quite the talk about telemarketers. That was quite the opening you gave us.
Sorry. And hello, Simon.
Hello, Dan. Hello, screen watchers everywhere. It's good to be with you.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded. Come get the girls. I have to stay here with Woodrow.
I'm not the chauffeur. I'm the grandfather. Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, mile 75.
Last train. Junior stargazers and space cadets. Each year we celebrate Asteroid Day.
Yes, Asteroid City has finally made its way into cinemas this week. It's been around an awful long time, floating around the schedule. This is a new Wes Anderson film, all set in a dusty, small desert town that is about to see the arrival of a alien ship. People are coming from everywhere to have their first close encounter. And what we find in a very Wes Anderson sort of way is that the people of this small town are very unusual, and they're all beautifully framed, because what Wes Anderson does is frame and color in his frame beautifully, whether that's with the stunning orange and ochres and light blues of the desert sky and the sands and all the surrounds, or whether it's with the unusual characters that always populate a Wes Anderson film. Wes Anderson is able to create a very unique movie-going experience. He's also very divisive in the way he tells his stories. It's sometimes very hard, which I have found in the past, that it's hard to connect with what Wes Anderson does. But when I do connect, as I have done with Asteroid City, I found it a really charming, very sweet story, not unlike Jim Jarmusch's throwback to the zombie genre a few years back in that film he did with Bill Murray, whose name I can never remember. But this is a real love letter to the B-movies of the 50s and the 60s, and Wes Anderson seems exactly the right sort of person to make that, I guess. Who would have known, but he is, because Asteroid City is wonderful.
I found this to be my least favorite of the Wes Anderson films. I thought it was incredibly flat. It, to me, felt like a person doing an impersonation of Wes Anderson. The spirit, the sharpness of it, the integrity and originality just wasn't there. It was pastiche. It was Wes Anderson just aping a Wes Anderson style. He's on cruise control. I don't know what was happening here, but I did not care for it. What I will say to Simon is Grand Budapest Hotel, which is not one of my favorite Wes Andersons, it's kind of mid-tier, but people seem to really love that and respond to that one for whatever reason. That film, it used this interesting framing device where it was kind of like a babushka doll, like one of those Russian nesting dolls, where it opens up with a girl in a park, if I remember correctly, reading a book. And so we actually see like a few levels in, as you know, we're reading in books and having stories being recollected and whatnot. Ever since then, and he got a lot of kudos for that, for playing around with form and structure, it seems as though he's really quite intent on doing that within his productions. So we saw that with the next one being French Dispatch. That was a New Yorker style magazine. And all the stories we saw in that, because it was a bit of an anthology, were stories being told as part of like an editorial meeting at this magazine. So again, it was playing around with different sort of structures and time.
Another
like,
film I loved.
Time pieces. See, I didn't care for French Dispatch at all. And the problem with French Dispatch for me, I thought, was the black and white sequences that I thought really took away from Wes Anderson's strength, which is this sort of bright, interesting visual palette, but you know, whatever. But you've got that. And then you've got this third film now where he's also playing around with structures, where we're not seeing a story of people out in the desert. We're actually watching a TV show special about the production of a play, which is about these people out in the desert. So again, there's like several sort of levels removed, and there's characters that sort of break away from being the character that you want to see them in the desert and suddenly have their own sort of relationship issues as actors. And sure. It's all a bit much. And I just kind of feel that Wes Anderson has so much artifice in the stories that he presents. Like there's so much construction happening already that when you start layering in these additional elements of what you're watching isn't necessarily a strict representation as to what's taking place. There's unreliable narrators. There's unreliable sort of narrative constructions happening.
This is all the joy to me.
It's too much. It is too much. Like I just think it takes away from the sort of raw connection that I think it was possible to have with what were some fairly silly constructed characters in the earlier films.
I thought it was that's the tightrope that he walks so perfectly. And I think his best films have been these last three films where he's explored this relationship between the film that he's making, the creation of the world on screen by his artificial characters and how that relates back to him and what he does. And I was totally on board for the layer upon layer upon layer of storytelling that he brings. It's all the way from the very darkness of the theater, the TV studio that then became a kind of a lighter theater setting, also in black and white, but then to the full color of Asteroid City, the play that was being staged. So, okay, we're at different ends of the critical spectrum on this one. I guess we'll have to just go our separate ways on Asteroid City. But I reckon, I don't think it's going to win over any new Wes Anderson fans. I think this is one that
I think it's just going to alienate old fans.
Oh, that's a pun. See, we did alienate with the whole thing there. That's clever. I think it's one for the fans and that have come along with him this way. So Asteroid City in limited release as we speak.
Well, Simon, that probably takes us to the next production. It's a Apple TV Plus series called Strange Planets. I don't know why I did that voice.
What if our world wasn't the only one where existence is absurd?
Please refer to the danger menu for tips on how not to die.
If your seat is in the peril row, you must help us take the machine apart. Your reward is more legroom.
Strange Planet, Simon, I've got zero clue on how to even talk to you about this. I don't know how to...
Ooh, short review.
I mean, well, yeah. So this is the thing. So it's co-produced by Dan Harmon. It's an adaptation of a, oh gosh, what was the kid's name? It's a fully grown adult. I would say the guy's name is like Nathan Piler. It's like a web comic. And so what they've done is adapted this for the screen. And what you're looking at is a culture where everyone's thoughts and feelings are worn completely on their sleeves. There is no artifice in what they're saying. Like Wes Anderson would not get by in this world because there's no clever dialogue at all. People are very much saying sort of what's on their mind and aren't couching anything. They're not being polite. They're just being purely just a raw emotion being expressed. It's an anthology series. It's about 10 episodes long. And the first episode, I was watching it. It took about 5 minutes for me to be able to get into the vibe of it. Because even the way that characters speak is really quite different. So because people aren't lying and because people aren't couching sort of thoughts and having like, you know, polite euphemisms for anything, it's all very open and honest. So one of the funnier ones in the first episode is they talk about instead of like a sunburn, instead of a sun's hand, it's a starburn. Okay. It's like that kind of thing. Like it's, you know, it's silly, raw honesty. What you're seeing is an effort, and I think it's mostly successful, but a few other critics I read weren't really as enamored with it as I was. I personally found it to be a really soul-affirming, just, you know, a soulful experience by and large. Other people thought that it had the pretense to get there, and they weren't really quite connecting with it. So, you know, mileage will vary on it for sure. But because you got these characters who are just being raw and open, it just feels like every other anthology series we see at the moment, which purports to be about, you know, human relationships and finding connections with one another and, you know, achieving what you can do. Like, there's no difference between this and, say, like Little America, for example, or Modern Love, or one of these other half-hour relationship-based anthology series. But it is animated. It's got this really weird quirk where everyone is being sort of more emotionally available to one another. And for me, at a time period where we're not seeing anything that's particularly sort of weird or strange on TV in a really meaningful way, this feels just a little bit left of center to everything else we're watching right now and was kind of exactly what I want to see on TV. So I'm not going to binge this. This is not a show you can binge, okay? It is a half-hour show, which sometimes you're going to struggle to hit the final like minutes of this program because it's not exactly what you're after. But you will sit back afterwards being glad that you watched it. And I think ultimately that's probably the greatest takeaway.
Another challenging bit of sci-fi from the people at Apple TV. They're doing good work over there. They like their speculative film and speculative series storytelling, and they do a good job of it. It's called Strange Planet on Apple TV Plus.
It's funny that you say they do a good job of it, Simon, because I appreciate that Apple TV is certainly ambitious, but I tend to hate most of their genre stuff.
But they do make you want to watch it. There's enough good stuff on there and enough sort of creative people that make you tune in, at least for the early episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I have to give everything a go to fill content on this podcast. So maybe I'm not necessarily the best, best sample audience here for this one.
Barometer, yeah.
I don't know. I look at shows like Foundation, for example, and the five or six other ones that I can't think of right now that I know that I watched the first few episodes of.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so many I have not cared for. But then there's a couple that I've really enjoyed. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. Sorry, Simon.
I headed off to the movies this week to see Dracula, The Voyage of the Demeter.
What on earth is a Demeter?
I don't know. What on earth is that voice? Why are we doing funny voices this episode? It's very strange.
I don't know.
The Demeter, on charter from Romania to London. Shipping private crates. Contents unknown. Out at sea with no land in sight.
Dracula, Voyage of the Demeter is taken from a chapter in Bram Stoker's Dracula novel. This is the story of how the Count was buried in dirt, put inside a coffin, and stuck on a ship that went from Romania to England. It's how he arrived on English shores, and how all the people on this boat come to horrible ends when he gets out of said dirt and coffin. It stars Corey Hawkins as Clemens. Yes, Dan Barrett, I see your hands raised.
Is this comedy?
No, it's not a comedy. Okay. No, in fact, there's no laughs in this at all, intentional or otherwise. This is a very stern-faced interpretation of the Dracula mythology. Corey Hawkins plays Clemens, who's a well-educated Englishman who's heading back to his home shores and has to start believing in something other than what his education makes him believe, makes him accept as being the truth. And the rise of the great undead Count is staged in some pretty spectacular fashion. It also stars Aisling Franciosa, who Australian audiences will know from her lead role in The Nightingale a couple of years ago, and a cast that is pretty much just chomp food for the Dracula when he gets free. Most prominent amongst them is Dasmalchian, who we know from Suicide Squad, coming up in Late Night of the Devil. He's been doing good work for a long time. So it's directed by André Uvedal, who I've been a fan of since he directed Trollhunter. This one, he's got a fairly sort of expansive budget to work with, and some of the big ocean stuff and the giant ship stuff looks fantastic. It's just not very scary. The Dracula himself is kind of a animalistic killer. He's just a bat with wings, which I guess is an interesting take on the Count, but it doesn't make for a very scary movie.
And but what it is, Simon, it's a very traditional take on bats.
Yes, it is a very traditional take on bats. This is a movie that makes you that reminds you what a great job Ridley Scott did with Alien and what John Carpenter did with The Thing. It's about a bunch of people stuck together in a tight sort of environment with a baddie on the loose, a monster on the loose. And those two movies are how this could have been. This one certainly isn't Alien or The Thing. It'll pass the time for people who want a scary movie this weekend.
Okay. And sometimes that's enough.
Sometimes that's exactly right.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm going to pivot. I'm going to talk about the new HBO original miniseries documentary. It's called Telemarketers.
Hey, what's up?
Where are we going into?
We're going into Civic Development Group. And what we do is we call up people and chisel them out of money.
Money on my motherfucking mind.
Patrick and I both work at this telemarketing place.
I was this 14-year-old kid making calls on behalf of charities.
It's like a big-ass cookout.
Get money at my motherfucking mouth.
I didn't think I was doing anything bad at all.
Now, Lisa, these families, they do need your support.
The business model is defrauding the most vulnerable in this country.
It was a big-time scam.
This is capitalism.
A couple of weeks ago, I pressed play on Telemarketers, Simon, and I had no idea what to expect. I'd been sent through a screener link with very little context. All I knew about it was that there were some very funny people involved in the production of this in some way. Listed as producers, you got the Safdie brothers, who are the guys responsible for like Uncut Gems is probably their biggest thing. Not necessarily ha-ha funny, but are certainly comedy adjacent and, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, beloved in that space.
Uncomfortable comedy.
Uncomfortable comedy, but like Danny McBride's in there as well. So, you know, suddenly people who are known funny people. Sure. And I heard they were involved in this documentary, and I figured that I was looking at a doco that would probably be something along the lines of like an HBO documentary meets Workaholics is largely what I was expecting.
Oh, okay.
And
you
what
liked
I got
Workaholics
is
too, didn't you?
Yeah, but like what I got is certainly not that. The idea behind Telemarketers is you've got this young guy who he's a mid to late teenager. He ends up, he either leaves school or graduates, I forget. Can't really get a job, but he ends up getting this gig in a really low rent telemarketing company. So to give an idea as to the sort of work that was happening by these telemarketers, one of the first clients that he has is a like a fireman's union or something like that. And they do fundraising once a year for a dinner that they all go to. So let's say they made $8,000 through their fundraising efforts. What this telemarketing company did was saying, hey, look, usually you make $8,000. We're going to give you, say, $15,000. And we're just going to do all of your fundraising for you sort of after the fact. So you've got your larger check. Go off and spend, have a good dinner. Meanwhile, we're going to collect money in your name. Okay, good deal for the fire guys. Like, you know, they've doubled what they usually make. And, you know, in theory, everything's fine. But what's not taken into consideration is the brand reputation of that fireman's union, because the guys at this telemarketing company are all incredibly low rent and will say anything to get their sale. Okay, even though none of it's commission-based, people are just working on an hourly, but it's bizarre. I don't understand why these people are doing what they're doing, but essentially, they'd be doing that for this group, but then the company starts expanding into other areas which are far more ethically dubious. So one of the things they start doing before they get the attention of the feds is they are raising money for a local police union. Okay, it's like a police union fund, like a pension type thing.
Yep.
Okay, so it's for like the it's for fallen officers and their families. Sure. So they're raising money for them. Okay, but they're purporting to be police officers themselves. And the reason why you do that is because if you call up someone and just cold call them out of the blue and say that I'm fundraising for the police, okay, you might hook them, you might not. But if you actually say that you're from the police, okay, then you're more likely to actually get that sale, okay? And that's for a couple of reasons, okay? One, there's just the thing that people like supporting police, okay?
Sure.
And keep in mind as well, for context sake, this is 2011. It's not a, you know, ACB level, you know, burning down police station sort of vibe from the last couple of years. Yep. Keep that context in mind. But yeah, people wanted to support the boys in blue. Okay. Or there was also the other sort of subtext going on, which was that people who gave the money would also receive a sticker from the police they could put on the back of their car. And the subtext is very much based around the idea of protection racket.
Oh my God.
Keep that in mind. Anyway,
you know, this is sounding very much like a Danny McBride thing. This could be the Righteous Gemstones, or this could be.
Yeah, absolutely could be. It is not a laugh out loud comedy thing. It's basically just the, oh my God, can you believe they're doing this? Just terrible
thing.
He
works in that immoral sort of comedy drama way. So this sounds, this could very much be Danny McBride.
Yeah, but it's not laugh out loud, and it's not like ha-ha comedy by any means. It's kind of just like soul-destroying comedy. So this telemarketing firm engaged in that kind of behavior, but then the feds get involved and the company changes management, not necessarily the people in management, but, you know, corporate names and structures, and rebrand themselves entirely. But they rebrand themselves in a way which is far worse than, the problems that have been sort of called on, okay? And instead rebrand themselves as, I forget what it is, like it's like the PUF, like the Police Union Fund or something like that. And so they're purporting to effectively be the police, and the staff working there are like officers of the fund. And so if people are like, oh, are you, you know, do you work for the fund? They're like, yeah, we're officers of the fund. So they're able to maintain that integrity going through while having zero integrity going through this.
Now, we should point out, this is a documentary. This is archived footage that's been unfolding over decades.
What this is actually from is these two guys. So one is that teenager I mentioned at the very beginning who starts working for this telemarketing company. And this other guy who's just a meth head, he's a guy who turns up to work, okay, is barely functional, does a bit of meth. Suddenly he's on the phones, he's selling, he's one of their best salespeople. He functions incredibly well while scamming people while he's on meth. Like, that's his superpower.
Oh, I got to watch this show. This sounds really interesting.
So you got these two guys, and at one point they decide they're going to bring down the telemarketing company. Okay, so like this kid, he's been filming some of it. And again, 2011, it's early days of YouTube. So they were recording YouTube videos and putting it online, just showing people, can you believe the wild and crazy environment we're working in? Okay, so like that was getting some hits online. And he got a bit of a talking to by management, but, you know, they just stayed out, you know, out in the world. But they start filming this thing because, you know, they're a bit inspired by like the Michael Moores of the world. And so decide they're going to bring down this company through their documentary. But both of them are, putting it as politely as possible, dead shits. And neither of them really know how to make a documentary, let alone stay committed to the idea of continuing to film the documentary. So what we see is the footage of them making their documentary, but over a course of like 15 years, but actually it wouldn't be 15 years, 12, 13 years. So 2011 to now. And you're seeing them like just jump ahead in terms of age and how they look. And neither of them age well, I will certainly say that much. But you see them as they age, like through this process, and it's purely because they don't know what they're doing. So they're just kind of jumping from like one situation to the next. By the end of it, you'll come away with seeing a story about two guys who you kind of want nothing to do with because they're telemarketers, the scum of the earth. Okay. But they're both kind of charming in their own way and have like an interesting sort of life perspective. And you wish them well, would be the sort of polite thing to say about it at the end. It's an engaging documentary. It's not really necessarily funny. I don't know that it's all that educational, but it's certainly an insight into a world that I don't think most people usually try to walk through if they can avoid it.
Wow. Well, as an ex-substance-fueled sales executive, I'm keen to see this. So where do we see it? It's on Max in the US. Where do we see it locally?
So it's an HBO production in the US, and as with all HBO stuff in Australia, you get here on Binge.
All right, I'm checking it out. It's called Telemarketers. That's interesting. And now the review we've all been waiting for, based on a true story, Gran Turismo.
Who do you think the best driver is?
Probably Rory.
I would dust him in a lap.
Jan, all you do is play video games with some crazy dreams of racing cars.
Dad, you're the one that told us to always do something we love.
You know what racing cars cost?
Okay, Simon, people have surely seen the trailer for this, and it is awful looking. Is the movie as bad as the trailer suggests?
Not at all. Not at all. And I'm going to go straight out. I'm going to take pole position on this. I'm going to be full of racing car puns. Settle in, everybody. Strap in your seatbelts. The film is based on a true story. Now, I went into this film not knowing anything about this, even though I'd seen the tagline based on a true story. My initial reaction was, what, is this how they thought of the game, or is this how the game came together? I don't get why it would be based on a true story. And I'm going to get to the end of this and say they probably should have given it a different name, because Gran Turismo is only associated with the video game, which this film will try to convince you was actually born out of a very high-tech driving simulator, which may be the case. But this is the true story of a young man out of the suburbs of Wales who wants to make something of his life and do it on his own terms. And he's given that opportunity when his obsession with the Gran Turismo video game leads to him being chosen to be part of the GT Academy, which is a legitimately run Formula One, I want to say, driving school that is thought up by Orlando Bloom's marketing executives as a way of putting kids in the driving seat of high-powered Formula One cars, essentially rockets on wheels, and they're going to try and teach a kid to drive this sort of car on the racetracks of the world, ending at the famous Le Mans track. Orlando Bloom plays the wily, sinewy old marketing executive very well in this. You've also got David Harbour from Stranger Things as he's the Mr. Miyagi kind of role in what is essentially the Karate Kid. Get it? Karate Kid. It was either going to be that or the Karate Skid. Both of them are very good puns. So I've got the thumbs down for those watching. So what you have here is, yeah, it's a true story about a kid played very well, I've got to say, by an actor who I'd not seen anything of over the years. His name is Archie Madekve.
Archie Madekve.
Archie. He plays Jan Mardenborough, who was the real-life person. So what I didn't realise about this is it's directed by Neil Blomkamp, he of District 9 and a bunch of inferior films since then, and he is brought on board to put you right in the driver's seat, and he does that. The action scenes, the driving scenes are very engaging and very immersive. What isn't so immersive and what isn't so engaging is kind of the fairly rote kid from the suburbs or kid from the sticks making his way to the top of the sports game. I'd seen all this before, and the stuff was enlivened by the action scenes, which should be enough for people who are going along to see a fast car movie. It's all up there on the screen, as is the wonderful Jerry Halliwell from Spice Girls, who is now Jerry Horner, but she was Jerry Halliwell.
Acting
on the screen as well. Yeah, she plays the mum, and quite good. She's opposite Jimon Hunsu, who was the father. And they have some good moments together. It's all about the action. The action's all up there on the screen. It covers all the beats it needs to cover. And it's damning with faint praise, but it's better than it deserves to be, I guess you could say.
So, look, I'm fascinated. I can't wait to see this movie. Not at the cinema, but like when I'm bored on an afternoon at some point.
No, you got to go and see it on the cinema. It's definitely a big screen one. And what Neil Blomkamp does with the computer graphics of this to make the driving simulation real is pretty impressive. It looks really good. It's the best thing he's done since District 9 for sure.
My opportunities to get shore leave are limited, and I don't think I'm going to take the effort to go and see Gran Turismo in the limited amount of free time I have.
Orlando Bloom.
Oh, well, sorry. Orlando I stand corrected. Bloom. I stand corrected.
When was the last time you saw him on the big screen? Yeah, that long ago.
I honestly don't know. If you ask me what he looked like, I know what he looked like as Legolas back in the Lord of the Rings films, but yeah. I don't think I could tell you what he generally looks like. Maybe I have seen him in stuff. I just have no idea.
Well, you've got that video on him on the surf ski when he was with Katy Perry. I know that you're a big fan of that one.
I actually don't know what you're talking about, but I hope to correct that as soon as I get off this here podcast.
Google Orlando Bloom, Katy Perry on a surf ski, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Already done. On that note, Simon, let's move on to the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Okay, Simon, explain how this segment came about, because I know both of us came to this with huge enthusiasm.
We did indeed, yes. I thought it might be fun to talk about vampires in movies, and you said, I don't know anything about vampires in movies. I hate vampire movies. We're not going to talk about that. You came back with, I'd rather do long boat voyages on movies, which immediately I thought you were serious about, so I started researching, and then I realized, he's just being a dick about it.
No, here's the thing. It was a dual purpose. One, I was being a dick, but two, I was fully prepared to talk about boat movies and TV shows.
let's put a pin in that one and come back to it. So what we decided to do was, I think I used it in the text I sent you, a gossipy grab bag of news and reviews. So this is the screen watching news grab bag of what's been happening around this week and our fleeting opinion thereof. Let's go.
Okay. First bullet point we've got here is the 2022-23 Emmy Awards. So hot off the press this morning is a date has been announced for the 15th of January, 2024. Okay. Now, this is an unexpected. So usually what happens is the Emmy Awards take place in the first week of the TV rating season in the US. So TV rating season kicks off usually the second week of September, thereabouts, sure. Early to mid-September. That's when their season starts. In Australia, we go more like a February to late November sort of a thing, or at least back in the day where ratings actually mattered. In the US, they go September through to May. So the Emmy Awards would be the event that would kickstart that week or like that year of the, like, sorry, would kickstart that season of the thing. Yeah. So not the award season, but like the season of television, the important season. Mm-hmm. So that had happened, but there's currently strikes taking place. And the thing that you can't do while strikes are taking place is prepare for and mount a large, lavish TV awards program. Because
nobody to write jokes.
Nobody's to write the jokes. You can't get, you know,
walk the red carpet.
Can't get a director to direct the program. You can't get, you know, just doesn't happen. Also, you don't want to have, you know, scab labor producing that and then having like all the cameras around as you watch the various sort of movie and TV stars and writers all picketing the event outside. Not a great look for anyone. So got to delay it.
Television, though, it'd be fun.
Yeah.
That sort of want to break the picket lines. I could imagine sort of James Franco throwing a tomato at someone. That'd be fun to watch.
I'm not sure if James Franco is really allowed out in polite society anymore, Simon. Not the best example, but I get your point. Bloom. Yeah, Orlando Bloom. And everyone's like, are you a writer? Like, who are you? So you can't stage it in September. So they were looking for a time period where they can do it. And January has been long suggested as probably the time where it'll happen. And that's what's happening. Sure. So they announced it for the 15th. But what I find interesting about this is that the nomination period for the awards end mid to late June, I think it is. So by the time that these awards are actually staged, we're looking about 6 to 7 months since the eligible programs, like the end of eligibility. So don't forget, that's programs for like the year prior leading up to that. Wow. Okay. Which means that when you're sitting there in January 2024, you'll be watching all the awards being won in the drama category by Succession. Okay, which is a drama series, which is mostly pretty funny. Okay, so already the categories are kind of awkward. But you'll be watching awards given for a show that aired 7 months prior.
Lacking in relevancy?
Well, here's the other thing. The other awards nominated, well, the other awards given will probably be for The Bear, okay, which is a comedy program, which is largely pretty dramatic, which is confusing itself there. Okay. But then it's not the episodes that aired in 2023. It's the episodes that aired in 2022. So it's not the most recent season of The Bear that you will have seen 6 months ago when you watched these awards, but it'd be the one from 18 months ago. Simon, This is baffling. Baffling.
Why are they doing it? Why wouldn't they just? I mean, I know they've got sponsorship arrangements and broadcast arrangements, so they have to have, like, they have to have a Dead Rubber in the Ashes, or they have to have the third State of Origin. They've got broadcast commitments and they've got sponsor commitments, but I mean, who's going to lean into this? Who's going to watch this?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's confusing. Like, ratings are diminishing for the Emmys awards just generally. Yeah. Like, this doesn't help.
That's the last thing the award shows need right now. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I used to love the Emmy awards, and I'm going to just very quickly bust out my standard talking point on this now, which is that the Emmy awards are broken. The Oscars are broken. What they need to do is stop thinking about it so much in terms of siloing film away from television. They need to embrace it a little bit more like the Golden Globes and start mixing the two, because you already have so much talent both in front of the camera and behind the camera. Code switching back and forth between TV and cinema, why not just have a shared award show? But what you do is you split it into two. You have scripted being your, you know, regular movies and TV dramas, and then you do an unscripted program, which allows you then to look at feature documentaries, reality shows, and, you know, high-end unscripted documentaries, documentary narrative series.
Streaming in a cloud again. Yep.
Yeah. Look, I think it's a really simple fix, but it doesn't work because the organizations behind it are so fragmented based on the distribution method. But anyway.
All right, let's move on to the next bullet point on the intermission. You had down here the most popular TV shows of 2023 so far. Do you mean that you and I like, or that in viewership numbers? Are we going down the that path with this? Where do you want to run with this?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the only thing I ever care about is how I feel about things. Okay, but the premise of what I'm talking about here is that there was a list published in Bloomberg sites earlier this week, and basically it was just listing, hey, look, these are the TV shows that have been the most popular, the most viewed on streaming services in 2023.
Right.
So is this gonna surprise my question, I was going to say, like, what do you think? What would you like list as being some of the most popular shows?
Okay, so we've sort of touched on this because the shows that have had a lot of the coverage are the White Lotuses, the Successions, those sort of shows.
Yeah.
I would also say that there's some of the Netflix stuff, which we don't really touch on, the Ginny and Georges and those sort of things. And you have always flown the flag for the flyover state series like Yellowstone, which really have the big numbers. So I'm keen to see what this article says.
Well, I mean, that's kind of exactly it. So you get the sort of, you know, like the media bubble shows. So the ones that people working within media tend to really gravitate towards. So that'll be things like Succession. Okay. But when you actually look at the five most viewed shows of 2023 on the streaming services, okay, this is as per data from Nielsen. Okay, the top five, and I'll go from five through to one. So The Last of Us on HBO Max, You on Netflix, Ted Lasso on Apple TV Plus, Netflix is The Night Agent, and then the number one show is Ginny and Georgia. And I don't know about you, Simon, but the number of times I see anybody talk about Ginny and Georgia, I can count on one hand. Never happens. But yeah, it just speaks to this idea that you've got all these shows that are currently being very widely watched. But I guarantee more people are watching Virgin River on Netflix than they are Succession.
And what about the traditional NBC Friday night comedies? What about the CBS drama blocks? So what sort of numbers are they doing?
So this is based off Nielsen streaming figures. So it's just purely the streamers. Okay. It's not. Yeah.
Yep.
So it's
a bit different. I would suggest that those broadcast ones, although broadcast has been in such a decline for such a long time that, you know, well, I don't know what the cool shows are now, but your Big Bang Theories and your How I Met My Mothers were still doing bigger numbers than any of the streaming stuff.
Look, I mean, if you want to think about it in terms of actual shows that exist now, Simon, you can probably look at you can look at like your big sort of franchise things like your SVUs and your FBIs and all those sorts of things. And they're probably doing numbers these days which are fairly comparable to the most successful of these big streaming programs. Okay, but where the big streamers are a bit different, and this is why it's a bit apples and oranges. If you think about the numbers tuning in for, say, the latest, Law and Order SVU, okay, while it may be sort of bigger than, say, an episode of Ginny and Georgia is going to be on that platform for like a couple of years to come, still racking up viewership as it goes on. So the shows exist not so much on a weekly basis as much as there's a month-long period where they're getting most of their viewership, and then there's like a long tail effect on these programs. So it's a bit different. They're not really quite comparable.
All right. Let's move on to the next gossipy grab bag of news and reviews sort of stuff. The Barbieheimer effect. Now, what Barbie and Oppenheimer have seemed to have done, which Avatar couldn't do, which Top Gun Maverick couldn't do, is to start to get people back into the regular going to the movies sort of a rhythm, I guess you could say. Generally, August is considered a bit of a dumping ground for late summer releases, but what we're finding is that new films over the last couple of weeks, like Meg 2, like the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle film, and even some of the older films like Pixar's Elemental, are finding surges, better than expected opening weeks, stronger fourth and fifth weeks. So people are maybe sort of drifting back to cinemas, or not even drifting back, coming out in fairly significant numbers to see these new films. Keen to see whether that rolls into the weeks ahead. And before you pointed out, there is a exception that proves the rule with the underperformance of Haunted Mansion at the box office. But generally, there's a lot of people heading back to cinemas, and that's a good thing.
Okay, so I'm actually going to call bullshit on this one based on the numbers.
No, I knew you would. I was literally about to say, okay, don't stick a pin in this because I think it's real. I think it's valid.
Okay, well, feel free to defend this afterwards. But if you think about what the films are we're talking about here. So you mentioned Haunted Mansion, which did not perform. Okay, like it just did terribly. But also, the struggle at the moment, and just in Haunted Mansion's defense, is they're trying to release these movies which have big star power behind them. And when they were greenlit, the idea was that you'd be able to release a movie like Haunted Mansion, you'd be able to take the cast out on the various sort of late night talk shows, on that show where people eat hot wings, what's called Hot Ones. You know, I think that's the number one destination for anyone trying to promote their movie now. But like, they can't do any of that now. So you're getting these films which should have performed perfectly fine. Okay, but just can't, because you can't get stars to cross picket lines to promote movies.
But you can't talk.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, like, that's just the problem at the moment. Yeah. But if you actually look at the films that have performed well this month, I don't think there's a Barbieheimer effect behind any of these. So Meg 2, okay, keep in mind, Meg 2 is coming off the back of Meg 1, which was a huge success, the very first one. The first one for this opening weekend in the US pulled in $45 million. Meg 2 only brought in $30 million. Okay, it performed really well internationally, but when you actually look at where it performed well internationally, it was China. So when you actually start breaking down the numbers on it, Meg 2 brought in, what was it? It was $115 million international, $39 million in the US. So it's already underperformed from the first Meg. But then if you actually look at where that international figure is, it's something like about $53 million is coming from the Chinese market.
It's way ahead of expectations. It's way ahead of what was expected of it in terms of...
Okay, just one second here. Simon, can I finish my sentence? Simon, let me finish my sentence. Simon, let me finish what I'm saying here. $53 million of that take. So it has outperformed what they expected, because they were expecting this to be a massive turkey.
That's exactly my point.
It's performing well in China.
No one expected it to be a massive turkey.
Yeah, but Simon, it's performing well in China. We're reporting $53 million of all of that. Okay, yes. And you can't talk about the Barbieheimer effect there, because Oppenheimer hasn't opened in China. Barbie opened the same week as the Meg 2, and it opened in sixth behind the Meg 2. So like, there's no Barbieheimer effect there. But where Meg 2 has actually managed to perform really well is thanks to its co-lead, which is this guy named Wu Ying, who was the guy that led Wolf Warrior and The Wandering Earth. So like, it's got this massive star power there, which is why that's actually really performed quite nicely. And it's been hard to actually gauge how things will perform in China. So I think they expect us to underperform, because every big Hollywood release this year has underperformed in China. This is the one that's actually been the exception to the rule, not the Barbieheimer effect, but it just had a really good lead and actually had a reason that the Chinese market wanted to go out and see this movie. So it's not the Barbieheimer effect. If you want to look at the other titles in there, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Mutant Mayhem. The success of this one, it isn't because of Barbieheimer effect. If anything, I reckon Oppenheimer's probably harmed it a little bit. I think the success of TMNT has come purely off the back of everybody saw what they did with the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse cartoon, and then suddenly saw they're doing a very similar thing with TMNT. So it certainly outperformed what was expected based on those awful live action TMNT films from the last couple of years. And I think it's coasting off Spider-Man a little bit more. The reason why I think that Meg 2 and Ninja Turtles have probably been harmed by Oppenheimer is that both of them actually have a fairly similar audience to Oppenheimer. And what I think is probably happening is that you're going to see the sort of older man audience that might have been drawn out to Meg 2 or Ninja Turtles have opted to go and see Oppenheimer instead. Don't forget that people aren't like you and I, Simon, who just go and see everything. Most people usually have a couple of movies they'll see a year, and they're not inclined to go and see something because they had a good time 2 weeks ago. They'll be looking for the next thing that kind of meets like their taste, what sort of zeitgeistly hitting them. So I think that this is an audience that probably would have gone and seen the Meg 2, because Meg 1 had done so well. Ninja Turtles has that lingering sort of thing where dads might have gone with their kids to go and see Ninja Turtles, but instead might be taking the older kid instead to go and see Oppenheimer. So I think it's working counter to what you're talking about. And also Elemental is the other one you mentioned. Elemental is like the real bizarre news story of the Hollywood season. This is a film that came out on the 15th of June. This was considered a complete turkey because it did not perform well on its opening weekend. But this is like an old school movie release, Simon. This is a film that isn't losing audience at all. It had a strong hold rate for its opening week, or sorry, the second week. So it opened on the 15th of June. By the end of June, it had only dropped 12%, and it's been consistent at that level ever since then. like movies back when I was a kid, like Home Alone would be released, you know, so big numbers, and then would still be in cinemas for months afterwards as people were still getting along to see it. Elemental was doing this, and this is bizarre for the current movie moment. So I think that there's success stories here, Simon, because I know that's what you're looking for. There are success stories, but it's not a Barbieheimer effect. This is just it's been a shitty, shitty Hollywood season for the most part. Okay. But in August, I think there's been a couple of titles that happen to come along that have actually performed in a way that they should have. And some of them outperforming probably what they expected, being things like that Ninja Turtles film and definitely Elemental.
You don't think that Barbieheimer effect is a thing?
No.
You don't think it's changed the way that people have gone to the movies over the last few weeks?
Okay, so that's a slightly different thing. So I would say that if we want to talk about a Barbieheimer effect, the recipient of a Barbieheimer effect has been Oppenheimer, because there were a lot of people who tried getting into Barbie who couldn't get tickets and instead went and saw Oppenheimer.
Oh, please.
No, that was a thing.
God's wallet.
No, it's a thing.
It built its own grant. It's not a thing at all. It built its own want to see factor, and there was plenty of people who were going out to see Oppenheimer.
No, people work on it.
There wasn't just a flow on effect from those that couldn't get in to see Barbie.
No, but like literally, Simon, that opening weekend for Oppenheimer, there were so many sellouts for Barbie that they actually saw like an uptick in some of the sessions for Oppenheimer around the place. So like that is a beneficiary of it. Okay, so you can't dismiss that. Barbie is like the absolute breakout success of the year, in a year where there have been no real breakout success stories.
Mm.
But like,
sure.
Yeah, okay. But like of anything to actually benefit from it, it's been Oppenheimer.
Mm.
Yeah, but these other films, there's no flow on.
All right. Well, we'll agree to disagree on that one again. Okay.
Look, Simon, get me the numbers that prove otherwise, and I'll be happy to jump on board.
Well, you're just interpreting figures to suit your argument. There's a whole lot of other debates. Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
Find me those figures, Simon. We'll talk about it.
Okay, we'll do that in the weeks ahead as part of a grab bag of stuff like this. That wasn't sort of the prepared sort of what we're going to go down. I'm going to mention very quickly another box office, what you could call it, a discrepancy, anomaly. Sound of Freedom is getting a lot of talk everywhere.
It's the Elemental for the SVU crowd.
That's exactly what it is. Sound of Freedom, which has found a local distributor with Icon Australia. It's coming out August 24. They're using a very clever sort of box office model where...
Sorry, that's Mel Gibson's Icon, isn't it?
That's exactly who it is, yeah. Where the distributor in the US, Angel Distribution, are buying up bulk tickets and then using what they're calling the Pay It Forward scheme, distributing these tickets for people to go to the movies. So there has been a lot of discussion from cinema owners in the US who aren't exactly complaining because they're still selling these tickets, but sold out sessions of Sound of Freedom are actually only 30% full because people aren't using the tickets, they aren't paying it forward. Angel has come out and denied that this is happening and that denied that the box office figures are inflated for Sound of Freedom because of this. But there is a lot of people sort of scratching their head and stroking their beard as to why this kind of distribution model is being sort of looked at in such an interesting way. So the Sound of Freedom, I haven't seen the film yet. The detractors say it's a bit of a QAnon-y kind of pedophile child trafficking rackets are everywhere. You just got to look and they sort of weigh in on that argument. Whereas right-wingers say that it's a straight QAnon-y sort of storyline as well. But we'll be able to tell in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I probably won't, but, you know, feel free to go ahead on this one.
I'm going to have to. But, yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I don't really have an ideological problem with it. It's just apparently it's not that good a movie. Like, apparently it feels like an extended episode of SVU, a TV show I don't watch, so I don't really know why I'd stick around and watch the film.
What's up next? You got one more bullet point?
One other thing was just an interesting series of conversations happening around like fan conventions in this past week or two. So you get like, you know, what people would refer to as like comic book conventions, but you know, they're just broadly fan conventions these days. Comic books don't factor into a lot of it. But they've got a couple of people who are sort of more, we'll sort of call them right-wing sort of aligned celebrities who've been very sort of vocal on stage of contravening the strike rules that have been put out of place for some of them. So people like Stephen Amell, who's the guy that used to star in Arrow, he now stars in a show called Heels, which is a wrestling program you can see here on Stan. So he was up there, and so he made a few comments. Zachary Levi, star of Shazam and, Chuck, he made a few comments, and refers to the strikes as being silly. And then suddenly in a couple of days afterwards had to walk back the comments at both. But then you had the most recent fan convention, which is this Star Trek convention that happens in Las Vegas every year. And you got this guy, Robert Beltran, who was in Star Trek Voyager playing Admiral Chakotay. Chakotay. That sounded like a weird, horrible Asian thing. He's supposed to be a Native American, but Robert Beltran is not a Native American actor anyway. It's anyway, so it's this whole thing. But anyway, he's a very traditional sort of right-wing person, just generally. But he was on stage and he was completely contravening the rules, where if you're an actor at the moment who's supposed to be striking, you're not supposed to be appearing at conventions, talking up the properties which are owned by the companies that are being struck against. And so things like a Star Trek convention's put in a really difficult place. We've got all these Star Trek actors who fans have paid good money to not only get into the convention itself, but you think about the Las Vegas convention. This is the big Star Wars convention of the, Star Trek convention of the year. The fans haven't just been locals who went, oh, I'm going to go to my local convention. This is the thing where people are traveling around the country, have paid up large amounts of money to get good accommodation. They've, gone to expense and real trouble to go to a Star Trek convention where the stars can't talk about Star Trek. So Robert Beltran's on stage talking about Star Trek, and everyone's like, well, you're a bit of a piece of shit. What are you doing here? You're completely going against us and our union. So you got that happening. But then you got people like William Shatner, who's kind of known to be a bit of a problematic contrarian, who's just up on stage and is just telling the people, hey, look, I can't be up here talking about this because this is the situation with the strike at the moment. This is what it's all about. William Shatner's doing the right thing. And that's all cool from I'm here in Australia listening to this, but I genuinely feel bad for fans that have spent large amounts of money months and months and months ago pre-strike, to get along to this strike, to suddenly find this big joyous weekend they had planned and have been looking forward to 4 months, if not years possibly. That's not getting anything out of it. And I feel really bad for these people. I understand the whole situation, but you can still feel bad for them.
Absolutely, you can. Yeah, these are their big outing for the year, traveling from interstate, all that sort of thing. So yeah, God bless the fans who are. We're certainly suffering through it as well. All right, so that brings to an end an intermission section that went over the gamut, let's say, of what we were going to talk about. So.
It's a good thing we made a concerted effort to keep our reviews tight this week.
I know, because that went out of control. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
Simon, I'm glad you asked. So. Look, I've been a lifelong comic book reader, but something that I haven't really sort of been that attracted to is some of the animated DC films. For the last, we'll say 10 years or so, maybe even slightly longer now, they've been producing a lot of direct-to-DVD, direct-to-streaming animated feature films. A lot of these are based on sort of fairly well-known comic book arcs or storylines in some way or properties that I've sort of been playing around with. But there was one that kind of caught my attention when it came out about 3 years ago, and I just never really got around to it, that I threw on the TV the other night. I was like, yeah, I'll give this a look. It's called Batman Soul of the Dragon. And what this one is, it kind of takes some of the, how do you even approach this? The 1970s sort of kung fu era of DC. So there was one character. So if you remember a few years ago, Marvel had the Shang-Chi thing. I'm trying to think what the actual name of the comic Shang-Chi. It's based on. It's like Shang-Chi Kung Fu Master, I think it's called. Something like that. I think that's the actual name of the thing. But it came from this era where suddenly Kung Fu movies were really big in the 70s. So the comic book company started churning out their Kung Fu superheroes. But they were never really superheroes. They were usually just Batman type figures getting around doing a whole bunch of Kung Fu. One of the main ones was this one called Richard Dragon. Then there's a couple of other characters. There's Bronze Tiger and, the one I could actually probably usually name and I can't do it right now. Female Kung Fu master. So you got these three characters. And so they've made this movie. It's a Batman-themed movie. But admittedly, Batman's not really in it all that much. It's kind of just these 70s DC Kung Fu characters with Bruce Wayne on his quest as a young man pre-Batman, joining them and meeting them and learning their ways of Kung Fu with their master. who's from comic books from the 70s and whatnot. But they've kind of readapted into this 70s era Batman animated film where there's a cult called the Cobra Cult, who are all very sort of snake focused. They want to get their hands on this sword, which opens up this pathway to like an underworld realm where, you know, they can bring some nasties out. So anyway, Batman gets involved in this. And so it's Batman teaming up with like his friends that he met when he was a younger man. And they're all just out on the streets of Gotham doing kung fu stuff and ending up back in like, you know, whichever Himalayan sort of mountain top. They're all sort of learning the sort of spiritual sort of learnings of kung fu through. It's ridiculously fun. I had so much fun with that. If you like the idea of 1970s pastiche, like this is ridiculously entertaining. I had no idea what I was in for with it. Loved it. On the counter side of that is this other film called Batman and Son, which I mentioned that these films are kind of based on like the comic book arcs. If you've been going along to a lot of the live action Marvel stuff particularly, and like you hear about how it's based on the comics, but like it's kind of tangentially based on the comics. It's not like these are strict stories that have been adapted through. If you want to get like a real pure distillation of what it's like to read a modern comic book these days, Batman and Son is absolutely in line with what you get from Batman comics at the moment. So the premise of this one is that, and this is a character that hasn't been explored much in the films, but if you remember the first Christopher Nolan Batman Begins film, do you remember the Liam Neeson character? He played a guy named Ra's al Ghul.
Yep.
Now, sure Ra's al Ghul in the comics, like he's kind of that guy. He's the head of the League of Assassins, but he's also a guy that's got access to the Lazarus Pit, which is a thing where when he gets like, you know, mortally wounded, they throw him in the Lazarus Pit for a couple of hours and he ends up sort of becoming rejuvenated and keeps on going. So he's been around for a few hundred years.
Ah, like the thing in Empire Strikes Back where they put Luke Skywalker underwater.
Yeah, pretty much. Kind of like that, but without a mask because he's not soft like Luke Skywalker. But anyway, they throw in the Lazarus Pit, he comes back. But in the comics, he's got a daughter named Shalia, I think is right. Anyway, the daughter is kind of like this love interest for Batman. And so that's actually been like the entry point into Ra's al Ghul. It's kind of through this sort of will they, won't they? It's kind of like a Catwoman sort of relationship he has with her where she's clearly evil, but, you know, the sexual tension, you can't get past it. In the comics, about a decade ago, it was revealed that they actually end up having a kid together. He didn't know about it, but he's suddenly introduced to his son, Damian, who's like the world's worst 12-year-old in that he's everything like Batman, in that he's like a real sort of, you know, up and get him action, you know, superstar. But he's also been raised by the League of Assassins. And so like, he's just this nasty piece of shit. Okay. He's just completely awful. And so Batman's got to take him in as his son. And so he ends up becoming like Batman's new Robin. Okay. So the Batman and Robin is actually a father and son story now. Anyway, it's huge fun, but this is literally like the Damian Wayne story as to how he meets his awful son and, yeah, the shenanigans that take place after that. Anyway,
and where do we watch these wonderful representations of pop culture?
I have no idea. I actually don't know. I know that these seem to crop up on both Binge and Stan every so often, but you can definitely buy them like direct through like Amazon or Apple or wherever. So if you want to spend like $3 or $4 and just rent something for an evening, give both these a go. You're going to have a really fun time with each of them.
I have also been watching a little show called The Backside of Television. This is the new series from your friend and mine, Mitch McTaggart, who has taken the vast history of Australian television and filtered it down into bite-sized comedic moments that he comments on, and he points out the absurdity of some of the stuff that's gone before on Australian television. He also highlights some of the really good things that we've achieved, but he kind of is playing that snarky millennial type of character, which he does very well and which is very, very funny in parts, ripping to shreds the sacred cows of our television history.
He's basically doing Charlie Brooker.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. And he's doing a good job of it. This is really funny and it's great to see. Last night we watched an episode where he referenced a TV show called Carrots. Now, I don't know if you remember Carrots.
No.
But it was an afternoon show and he put it within the context of all the arguments and fighting that was going on between the networks and the Australian Television, Children's Television Council or Committee, whatever it was called. And Carrots was deemed to be not particularly suitable for young children. It's about a man in a carrot suit who is the center of a TV show. In hindsight, it's a little bit like that Ed Norton, Robin Williams film, Death to Smoochie.
yeah.
But for those that know that, and carrots became central to this fight that ultimately brought down the Australian Children's Television Council. And McTaggart sort of presents this in a really entertaining and very funny way. But if you get a chance, duck onto YouTube and Google carrots TV series.
Okay, I'm definitely going to give that a look.
Yeah. All right, that brings to the end of the what else have you been watching section. Good section. Dan Barrett, are you ready to be tested by this day in history?
Okay, hit me.
August 13, 1997. Following its debut on this day, it would become the first weekly series to be hit with an MA rating for foul language. Name the show.
I was about to give like a few lines, but it's probably just gross lines from the show that I can't get away with on the podcast because we don't have an MA rating. Look, this is South Park.
Yes, August 13, 1997, South Park debut. Yeah. August 16, 1985, which Hollywood great guest stars as Willie Loman in the CBS TV adaptation of Death of a Salesman?
I've seen this one, and it starred, one, Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman, John Malkovich as well, but yes, it was Dustin Hoffman in the Willie Loman part, which I think he recreated from his Broadway performance as well.
Yeah, I think that's
August 2013, the 3D concert film This Is Us, which was directed by Super Size Me director Morgan Spurlock, features which superstar boy band that I know is your favorite?
It's not my favorite because my favorite is obviously BTS, Simon. But if we want to go a bit more old school, I guess back in the day, I probably would have said One Direction because that is, you know, the obvious.
That's exactly right. One Direction, This Is Us. Well done. All right. Birthday time.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
Now, I think this is a pretty easy one, but we'll see how you go. August 13, 1982, Sebastian Stan. August 14, 1966, one Halle Berry. August 16, 1958, Angela Bassett. August 17, 1991, young fella, Austin Butler. What do these four birthday buddies have in common?
I feel in this day and age of where we've seen pop culture over this past decade, it's pretty easy to look at almost all these quizzes you can do and say, oh, there's some sort of superhero shit involved in it. And I kind of feel that's exactly where this one's fallen in. So Sebastian Stan, obviously, you know, in the Captain America films. Halle Berry's had two bites at the superhero cherry with both incredible performances as Storm in the X-Men and then also in the, you know, I don't want to call it my favorite film of all time, okay? But, you know, I'm sure others would. A film called Catwoman. You've got Angela Bassett, who's been in a few different DC films over the years, playing Amanda Waller. So it was in the Green Lantern movie back in the day through to the various Suicide Squad films and I'm sure cropped up in a few other films here and there as well. And then Austin Butler. This is where I'm a little bit confused, but I'm willing just to go and instead of saying superheroes, I'll say all these people were in superhero-inspired attire and then I can squeeze Austin Butler in there as Elvis.
All right, well, you're wrong. Well, you're not wrong, but that's not the answer I was looking for. You were right about Elvis. They've all played in musical biopics or played real-life stars in musical or in biopics featuring these people. Sebastian Stan, of course, was in Pammy and Tommy.
Well, he co-starred in that role.
Co-starred in that role.
Why is it a co-star role, Simon?
Why is it a co-star role?
Because he co-starred alongside his very large prosthetic penis.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the penis was the real star of that. Halle Berry was Dorothy Dandridge. Angela Bassett was Tina Turner. Austin Butler was Elvis. There you go. Musical biopic stars or biopic stars.
I guess my bit of trivia for you, Simon, is which superhero inspired the Elvis one-piece jumpsuit?
Don't know.
That would be Captain Marvel Shazam, not the Captain Marvel from the Marvel films, but, you know, the Zachary Levi Shazam Captain Marvel.
Interesting. No, I didn't know that at all. Is that true? Was Elvis a fan of the comic books?
When he was a kid, he loved the Shazam comics.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, Dan Barrett, that brings us to the end of what feels like an epic podcast.
It only feels like an epic because we recorded a version beforehand and realized we couldn't use it.
I'm so exhausted.
Tough enough. All right,
do your sign off.
Okay, folks, my name is Dan Barrett. You can find me on Twitter at the Dan Barrett. You can find me at Threads at the Dan Barrett. You can find me on Blue Sky at danbarrett.bsky, however that works. I don't know. Start your day with my free newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. Find that one at alwaysbewatching.com. You find there the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. And then on Fridays, we've got the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which recounts the big shows that launched that very week.
Screen watching is all over your socials, on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast. Twitter is at @screen_watching. You can go to the Screen Watching YouTube channel. You can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. You can also go to the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival website and pick up this awesome t-shirt. For those of you watching, it looks a good looking t-shirt. As you can see, it fits my ample curves, so it's ideal for the large bosomed individual. Do that over at the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival.com website.
And of course, the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival isn't just taking place in Sydney, it's also taking place in Melbourne and Brisbane. And
yes, it is.
What weekends is this all happening, Simon?
August 24 to 27 in Sydney and Brisbane, and then a week later, August 31 to September 3 at Cinema Nova in Melbourne.
And are there any special events taking place within all of this that might be of interest to the screen-watching audience?
There are indeed. A young media analyst type from the Brisbane suburb, someone called Dan Barrett, will be presenting and opening some commentary at the start of the session of Electric Dreams, which is one of his favourite films from his youthful period. So get along to that.
So my current period.
Yes, your current period, yes. The one in which you're still bonded. All right, we're at the end of the podcast.
Okay, folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week. And obviously, tell your friends about the podcast. You can find us on your various podcast apps. Also, find the video of the podcast on YouTube and on Spotify. Folks, we'll be back next week with more Screen Watching. Forgot the name of the podcast. Folks, we'll see you then.